This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Well, hello there. How's your day? Good to be catching up with you this afternoon. Between now and the news at one, tell you about this State Farm lobby group, one of the lobby groups around the country, who's written to the federal government really wanting some more details on the biosecurity standards that have been put in place for this first shipment of bulk grain imports coming into Australia. In what was it, I think about, was it 12 years? Quite a long time anyway, since the last import of grain into this country. This particular shipment coming into Australia, into New South Wales in sort of maybe 8 weeks' time, not quite sure of the time frame at this point, but this group really wanting to know those details about those standards around biosecurity, because obviously those concerns of any pests and diseases coming into Australia. Also, the price of iron ore now above $100 a tonne. What does that mean for the mining industry here in Western Australia? We'll get to that shortly before the news headlines at 12:30. And after reading the front page of the West Australian today, it seems the recent run of farm invasions by animal rights activists is being guided by a manifesto, a how-to guide by animal liberation group Direct Action Everywhere. Now, the guide apparently tells followers that they're following in the footsteps of Martin Luther King Jr., and that activism, not veganism, is the only way to give animals autonomy over their own bodies. The global movement call the tactic open rescue. But from a farmer's perspective, it's simply illegal trespassing and theft of stock. Now, earlier in the year, the leader of Direct Action Everywhere, James Warden, faced a string of trespass charges, including one for entering a Pinjarra piggery and broadcasting the conditions inside, and he was fined as a result of that $7,000. The Minister for Agriculture, David Littleproud, he's officially not on deck today after the federal election, but he was quick to go into print. He's put out a statement about this morning, and he says that comparing farm invasion to the passive resistance championed by Martin Luther King Jr. is ridiculous and dangerous. And he also says many vegans have contacted his office saying they don't support the actions of those invading farms. Rick Wilson is the member for O'Connor, and he says he's been contacted by farming families concerned about these activists trespassing on their properties.
I've got an email here in front of me that I received a few weeks ago from a mother of one of those families who was deeply distressed about the safety of her children having been targeted by this Aussie Farms map. So this is not something that doesn't directly impact on people's lives that Mr. Warden's been up to. We have, as a Commonwealth government, we are going to introduce a new offence with up to 12 months jail time for those who use a carriage service, such as the internet, to disclose personal information and to incite others to trespass on farmland and livestock facilities. So that is what we will be introducing into the Parliament once we return, looks like early July.
So immediate jail time, up to a year if someone is found to have trespassed or shared this personal information?
No, so the Commonwealth Government doesn't have jurisdiction over laws like trespass. That is up to the state government, and I'll come to them in a moment. But we do have jurisdiction over carriage services such as the internet. And if people use the internet to disclose personal information and to incite others to trespass on farmland, they will be liable for up to 12 months jail time.
Mr. Warden says that tougher laws won't stop him and his group. I mean, how do you stop that commitment?
Well, he'll have 12 months in jail, in between his offences to think about things. Unfortunately, the state government, which does have jurisdiction over trespass, I'm not entirely confident are going to enforce the full extent of the law. We've got a Minister for Agriculture who was quite happy to protest down in Fremantle with animal activists back in the day before she became the Minister. You know, at a Commonwealth Government level, we will be taking strong action.
Member for O'Connor, Rick Wilson with Stan Shaw. 12:10 here on the Country Hour. Well, speaking of this current trend to steer clear of animal products, I wonder if you're coming to the conclusion that milk isn't so good for you. Have you been told maybe by your personal trainer or a friend on Facebook or Twitter to cut down on dairy products and switch to plant-based milk alternatives, things like soy, rice, coconut or nuts, for example? Well, if so, don't go anywhere, because shortly you'll hear from a doctor who specialises in nutrition, and she says unless you're lactose intolerant, you're better off drinking good old-fashioned milk.
Milk is not just about calcium or protein or fats that we can add to another product. There are a lot of naturally bioactive components to milk. So, for example, protein in milk, it's not just protein. It's split between casein and it's split between whey. And those types of proteins have a different rate of digestibility in the body, which is you can't mimic that.
You'll hear more from that nutrition specialist shortly on the Country Hour. If you want a link to the story, make your way to the ABC Rural Facebook page. You can leave a comment there or just click through to the online story that Tyne Logan's put together, or text through your thoughts about that. 0448 922 604. What are you doing with milk? Do you still have heaps of it in the fridge, or have you started to steer clear a little bit? Let me know. 0448 922 604 to be part of that conversation. It is 11 past 12. Well, as the dust settles from the Coalition's weekend victory, the attention now turns to the makeup of the Morrison government's ministry. Now, it's likely to be a few days in the making yet, but ahead of a Nationals party room meeting tomorrow, there's speculation the junior coalition partner could seek to change up its responsibilities and regain the trade portfolio. Reporter Kath Sullivan asked Nationals deputy leader Senator McKenzie if she would like to be the next trade minister.
Well, that's a discussion for the Prime Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister to have. Obviously, the National Party and the Country Party before it always held the trade portfolio. It really is significant that 70% of our exports, being agriculture and mining, are from regional communities and the growing areas of trade in terms of international education and tourism. There are some opportunities there for regional communities. So that's a discussion, obviously, that will be held by the DPM and the PM over time, but I'll leave that to them.
Just on the coalition agreement, do you expect that the Nationals will retain 5 ministry spots?
Well, that's always been a mathematical determination, a very simple calculation of proportions of seats won at an election. So that'll be done once we know the final count. We know at the moment that the Liberal Party has 62 seats. They need 76 seats to be in government, and we've got 16. So obviously those discussions between the Prime Minister and the DPM will look at, well, we've got 14 seats here, the most successful partnership in Australian political history in terms of delivering prosperous Australia. Looks like it will continue, and I'm sure what the end construct of the coalition agreement will be up to them.
What is it that your party will be seeking from a coalition agreement, and will that agreement be made public?
As to the details of any coalition agreement, that's not for me to discuss on the radio at all. But I think our track record as a party is very, very clear over many, many decades that we seek from this relationship with the Liberal Party benefits for regional and rural communities and the industries that underpin them. And we won't back away from that at all going into these discussions.
I understand that the Nationals MPs and senators will be meeting tomorrow to consider the leadership. Is there any doubt as to Michael McCormack and whether or not he should continue as leader of the Nationals?
Well, I think, you know, Michael's done an amazing job as leader of the Nationals. He's been everywhere, 60,000 kilometres on the ground in regional communities, working incredibly hard to deliver a really strong result. As you said, the Nats were the only political party with a swing to us at this election. And that really says that is the reflection of the people for the type of work that our MPs do. And every single localised campaign was different and nuanced, and Michael actually assisted every single MP to win back their seat. So I imagine they will support him in the room because he's done an absolutely fabulous job.
So I can assume he has your support.
Absolutely. I'm his deputy leader.
And will you remain deputy leader after tomorrow's meeting?
Well, that will be up to the room. All leadership positions will be spilled, and that'll be up to the room.
And just before we finish up on the leadership of the Nationals, Barnaby Joyce did make some comments in the lead up to the election, suggesting that he would be happy to fulfil that role. How helpful do you think his behaviour and those remarks was to your party during the campaign?
Oh, look, I think Barnaby Joyce has played an absolutely significant role in building the National Party brand right throughout Australia and helping deliver seats, particularly at the last election. But his result this election for the New England just shows how much they back him in as their local member. He has a lot to say about the things that he cares about, and he articulates that in a really positive way, and nobody can doubt his passion for the things he believes in and for regional Australia. So that'll be a decision for Barnaby to make.
As to whether or not he wants to be leader again?
That'll be a decision he will either put himself up or not tomorrow.
Nationals Victorian Senator Bridget McKenzie speaking ahead of the party room meeting, which will be held tomorrow. 16 past 12, ABC WA, this is the Country Hour, Belinda Varaschetti with you. And as I was mentioning to you earlier, the New South Wales Farmers Association has written to the federal government and it wants more detail on the biosecurity standards that have been put in place for this bulk grain import that was given the green light just last week. Matthew Madden is the Grains Committee Chair for the association and he's called for a comprehensive stocks reporting system to be set up. And he says, we really need a system like this because it's going to provide greater transparency for not only the way grains are imported into Australia, but also to determine if there is even a domestic supply shortage.
Look, our number one premise is biosecurity. We believe that that should not be softened or that those standards dropped in any event.
Have those standards been explained to you by the government?
Yes, look, we first were alerted to the possibility of grain imports last October, and so we initiated contact with the department from then on, and we had a meeting with them in December to go through what the criteria would be and how it was to be implemented.
And have they been transparent in what standards have been applied to this?
At this stage, we think they could explain them a little further. We have written to them yesterday just to get a little further clarification and reassurance that absolutely no the standards and protocols haven't been changed. We sent the letter yesterday, so we're still awaiting a response on that.
And it's my understanding that the imports have been limited to Manildra only. Is that right? Is there any talk of expanding it?
We have heard there are other applications in the pipeline. Manildra are the only ones that have come forward to say that they were applying for a permit. And the department, to my knowledge, are restricted through the privacy to not to disclose who the other applicants are.
So is there a reason, do you think, to import this grain?
Well, we have the perplexing situation where the biggest buyer of Australian wheat is saying there's not enough, and the grain growers and grain traders, on the other hand, are saying there is enough, which brings to the point of we don't actually have a stocks reporting system in Australia to identify those stocks by grade, quality or location. And we're pushing for a mandatory system where we will get those answers. Both suppliers and producers and traders knew the amount of stock.
If grain imports are expanded, does that run the risk of driving prices down for local growers?
I don't think so in the short term. I mean, it's a bit of a double whammy. The international price of grain has dropped since harvest quite dramatically. And we have a lot of, and I can understand the anger and frustration of growers, and I'm a grower myself, that we're facing dropping prices, bleak outlook in some parts, and what I really consider a slap in the face with an imported grain permit being granted. I believe it won't be common because the numbers we've modelled, it's just too expensive to bring in overseas grain. Australian grain is always the cheapest to use within Australia.
New South Wales Farmers Grains Committee Chair Matthew Madden with Olivia Ralph. 19 past 12 here on the Country Hour. And if you grow canola, you're being warned to stick to the label application directions when spraying herbicides, or the industry risks losing valuable export markets. That advice is from the National Working Party on Grain Protection, and it comes after several samples of canola sold domestically had higher than acceptable residues of haloxifop, which is a chemical used to kill grass weeds. Chair of this group is Gerard McMullen, and he says growers need to be careful, particularly as the European Union has flagged it will lower the maximum residue limit on some crop chemicals.
The National Residue Survey have been monitoring residues on crops for many, many years, and there's been detected low levels of phylloxyphop above the Australian MRL on a number of samples. And so the industry got together and provided some advice to growers earlier this year, warning of the, the non-compliance with the Australian MRL. So this advice is just a follow-up to that, given that I understand that growers may be thinking of using this product in the next few weeks on their crops.
The samples that did exceed the MRL for this chemical, where were they found?
The samples were found on the normal National Residue Survey testing across the country.
So not specific to one state or anything like that. This is a national problem.
Yes, it's a national issue. Mm. There were some residues higher in certain areas than others, but that's to be expected given different usage patterns, environmental conditions, etc. But generally, it's a national problem.
Has the MRL been exceeded in international markets?
Not that I'm aware of, no. So this, when the NRS does their testing, it is based on assessment against the Australian MRL.
There is concern, though, about the EU changing some of its MRLs, reducing them. Is that another part of this concern about how this chemical is being used?
Yes. Well, look, overseas markets, including the EU, always reviewing their MRLs, and we have received advance notice from the EU that they do plan to drop their MRL. So that is of concern to the industry. We do need to look at the way that we are actually using this product, because when that MRL does drop, it means that it will be lower than the Australian MRL, and there will then be the potential for violations of the EU MRL if we don't do some appropriate management strategies to address that concern.
And what's the potential consequence if that doesn't happen and that MRL is breached?
Look, the EU has a specific policy on that, and generally it's a three-strike policy, and shipments would halt, but industry, I would hope, wouldn't get to that point. Whenever industry outloads, it's their responsibility to make sure that they're aware of the residues on cargoes. So I would hope that industry would take that responsibility very, very clearly and make sure that they're managing the residues on shipments to the EU before it got to that point.
We're talking about the use of halloxyphop in canola crops. My understanding is that it's used for grass weeds as well as the weed erodium. Is this chemical something that growers should only be using in the early growth stages of canola?
Yes. Look, as with all chemicals, the label directions need to be followed, and there's some pretty clear directions on the label for halloxyphop, basically that it shouldn't be used on canola after the eight-leaf stage and or after stem elongation. So as per normal practices, I would hope that industry would, certainly growers, would comply with label directions. It is a product that's freely available out there and is used fairly widely in industry. My understanding, though, as well, is that there are some alternative products out there that may be just as suitable. So that's something that that needs to be considered whenever growers are using particular products on their crop.
Gerard McMullen from the National Working Party on Grain Protection, which sits within Grain Trade Australia, speaking to Joe Prendergast. In other grains news today, and let me just... Oh, looks like my screen has just frozen momentarily. And I don't think I'm going to be able to get to that story. Let me just play around a little bit longer. No, I've got it. It's all good. In other grains news today, we're talking about soils, aren't we? Yes, here it is now. Ag scientists believe that WA farmers are losing as much as 2.5 million tonnes of yield because of sodic soils and transient salinity. Now, transient salinity is caused by the slow build-up of salt that falls in rain, and it's less understood than dryland salinity. But some research underway in the eastern grain belt hopes to tackle these problems. This year, 5 wheat and barley trials have been planted at Meriden, Beacon and Lake Grace. Department of Primary Industries project leader David Hall says the trials will look at a combination of different strategies aimed at increasing water availability to the root zone.
So we're looking at trying to ameliorate these soils, and one of the areas is really to harvest more of the rainfall. And that sounds a bit simple, but what we're trying to do is create areas in the interrow which can actually be used to harvest more water into the furrow where the crop's sown. And there's some work being looking at polymers and also the shape of the hills to be able to do this. And then the other thing is to try and get more water actually entering the soil by improving the structure of the root zone. The whole aim is that if we can get a larger volume of water into these soils, then that will be available to the plants, and also it'll start leaching the salts deeper down into the profile. So effectively what we're trying to do is increase the volume of soil available to plants that is less saline.
Deep Herd project leader David Hall with John Daly. That $4.8 million project is a co-investment between Deep Herd and the GRDC. And that 4-year project expected to finish in 2022 with the development of an agronomic package. It is 27 past 12.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
Iron ore prices are now above $100 US a tonne. That's the highest they've been in 5 years. Why? Well, China has hit record levels of steel production, something that surprised some industry analysts. And Brazil is currently having problems supplying iron ore to the world market. The good news for those with shares in WA iron ore companies is mining analyst Tim Treadgold thinks the prices will stay strong for at least a few years.
I don't think there was any doubt it was going to clear the $100 mark, and I think it's going to keep going. There's already talk of 110, but it could go well beyond that because it's a squeeze of reduced supply and rising demand, which is dynamite for a commodity.
How long could we see these supply issues pushing the prices up, do you think?
Well, it's entirely possible that it could last for 5 years. We had a Brazilian dam collapse back at the end of 2014. That was at a dam, a mine called Samarco. That mine is not back in production, and the major owner of it, the Brazilian company Vale, is now talking about it being back online in 2020 or next year. Now, that means that Samarco will have been out of production for 5 years. So for there to be talk of these latest mine outings, such as Brumadinho, the one which killed a couple of hundred people when it was flooded in a mudslide, to be making a quick return, I think is nonsense. I think the Brazilian authorities are going to be putting a lot of weight on the Brazilian iron ore industry, and it could remain in a crippled condition for some time.
And just how much iron ore does it take out of the market when we take Brazil out of the equation, Tim?
Well, it could be anywhere between 40 and 80 million tonnes, but the point is iron ore is an interesting commodity in that you can't store it. So there's a fine line, you can, but only not a lot, because it occupies a lot of space and it weighs a lot. It's not like copper, which you can store in a warehouse. Iron ore is a bulk commodity. It's not suitable for storing. So there's a fine connection between iron ore producers and steelmakers who buy the iron ore. So if you disrupt that fine supply line, you cause great pressure on the price. And if you remove 80 million tonnes out of a market which is about 1.6 billion tonnes a year. It might not sound a lot, but it disrupts the whole flow. And then companies have to go and find suppliers from elsewhere, or they wait for Brazil to come back online. So the net effect is pressure on the price.
It's so much more than that supply disruption from Brazil. It's coming at a time where there's also that record production of steel out of China. So is that sort of creating the perfect storm to push up the prices there, Tim?
Well, you could call it a perfect storm, because China has surprised everyone by producing steel at a record rate for the first time ever. The annualised run rate of Chinese steel production exceeded 1 billion tonnes, up 11% year on year. Now, that's not supposed to be happening. We're supposed to be in the middle of a trade war, and Chinese steel production is supposed to be declining, and maybe it will at a future date. But at the moment, you have got this supply squeeze and demand pull on the iron ore price, which is why it's above 100 and why it could easily go well beyond 100, 110, maybe up to 120.
From your observations, what are the big iron ore giants, the likes of the Rios, the BHPs, the Fortescues, how are they benefiting?
The problem for Australian producers is, do we sink a whole lot of fresh money into lifting production in the belief that Brazil's offline for a prolonged time? Or do we just enjoy the high prices and watch what happens in Brazil? Now, if you do that, you let other people back into the market. Mines that have been mothballed in other countries, such as India, could well come back online to catch the high prices. It's a devilishly tricky question, but at the end of the day, whatever BHP and Rio and Fortescue decide to do, they are going to make an enormous amount of money over the next 6 months and possibly 3 to 4 years. Who knows? It's just a great unknown. It's a real positive for Western Australia.
Mining analyst Tim Treadgold with Courtney Fowler, 28-1, and Ali Coven in the studio with the headlines.
Thanks, Belinda. The Premier Mark McGowan has urged the next federal Labor leader to have a greater focus on WA. Labor did not win any extra seats from the Liberals in the state at the weekend's federal election, and Labor's seat of Cowan is still in doubt. So far, senior MPs Chris Bowen and Anthony Albanese have nominated for the leadership position left vacant by Bill Shorten. There are reports of 6 protesters being killed and hundreds injured during demonstrations in Jakarta overnight. A small group of hardcore supporters of losing presidential candidate Prabowo Subianto clashed with riot police in Jakarta. The demonstration was met with tear gas and water cannon. 3,000 homes were left without power in Perth's north last night after a recreational drone reportedly crashed into power lines in Kingsley. Western Power says it's concerned by reports the drone operator risked electrocution by walking near the fallen lines to retrieve the drone. Thanks, Belinda. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for the update, Ali. 27-1. And asking you the question this afternoon, wondering if you've been steering away from milk, thinking that some of the alternatives are better for your health, things like almond milk, coconut milk, things like that. When you open the fridge, what are you seeing today? Are you seeing those cartons of the almond milk and the coconut milk more than the cow's milk in the fridge? On the ABC Rural Facebook page, a little conversation going on there. Jackie says, hell no, the more raw cow's milk, the better, not this vegan crap. Simone says, no thanks, I'll stick to dairy. Have tried the alternatives and don't enjoy it in the slightest. And this from Andrew, did butter have to worry about margarine in the end, or just keep doing what it does best? And on the text, 0448 922 604, Wayne says, we're a family of 5 and use 3 litres a day. 3 litres of, I'm assuming, cow's milk, but not sure, Wayne. And Steve says, milk, bottles of full cream in the freezer. And Nick in Nowangarup says, milk is from a mammal's breast. These people are referring to juice, i.e. almond juice, because as far as I'm aware, almonds don't have breasts. Thanks, Nick. 0448 922 604. Talk more about that shortly. And also taking you off to Katanning for the results of the sheep market this afternoon. Right now, it's off to the Weather Bureau, and joining us from the Bureau is Adam Conroy. Adam, we'll start in northern and eastern parts. What can you see?
There's very little weather through those parts at the moment, as is pretty normal for this time of year. I guess the main talking point up north is the above-average temperatures we're having through May. A lot of the Kimberley and the Pilbara are getting max temps up in around the mid-30s. I know Broome in particular is looking at breaking that run of days above 35 degrees. It looks over at least the coming 4 days that heat will continue up north, probably just maybe dropping about a degree each day as we eventually get some cooler air, or slightly less hot air running around the high pressure system and getting up there, but probably not until Monday or Tuesday next week that we see temperatures start to drop off a little more up there. The only real weather to speak of that we'll get outside the Southwest Land Division, tomorrow we'll just see a little bit of light rain develop over the far southern goldfields in the middle of the day before then clearing in the evening. Then on Saturday and Sunday we'll probably see some coastal showers on the Eucla, and the only other possible weather will be during Sunday where we'll see some mid-level cloud develop over the inland Gascoyne, and we might just see a little bit of light shower activity developing in that.
Into the Southwest Land Division now, and Adam, the burning question just coming through on text. Can you ask Adam why it's not raining?
Yeah, unfortunately, the high pressure systems are sitting fairway south and are very strong. It's just preventing the cold fronts getting through. I know it's getting a bit desperate in some places at the moment, but unfortunately, there's no real significant break in the pattern for at least the next week. All we're really going to see rainfall-wise is the odd weak front getting up and really just mainly affecting coastal parts. So probably the only other weather feature, well, I guess tomorrow is going to be driven by two weather features. We will have a weak cold front that will produce showers mainly along the south coast and along the west coast up to around Mandurah. North of that cold front, we should see overnight tonight into tomorrow morning a rain band develop. It'll be a reasonably narrow rain band by the looks of it, and overall probably rainfall figures in it will be in the order of 2 to 5 millimetres at best. We should see that rain develop through the lower west and the far south of the central west, probably through the southern half of the central wheat belt and northern half of the great southern, and then a little bit getting out to the southeast coastal district. So that'll develop overnight tonight, then clear by tomorrow evening. And as I said, not too much in terms of useful rain out of that. Unfortunately, going beyond that, on Friday, another weak cold front will drift through southern parts. We'll see showers initially near the western south coast. They'll eventually push through areas southwest of a line from around Lancelin across to Israelite Bay. But in terms of rainfall figures, I think we're really just looking at maybe up to 3 to 5 mils near the coast and only about a millimetre getting through to inland parts. So not a lot of rainfall in that. Then on Saturday, we'll see a high pressure system start to move in behind that front. So some south coastal showers are likely to continue through Saturday and maybe some very early shower activity along the west coast. But then that'll clear up as that high pressure system drops in. And then on Sunday, it'll move a bit further south. So some morning shower activity near the eastern south coast should then clear off. And it looks beyond that like the high will then move into the Bight and probably sit there till at least the end of next week. So no significant rainfall expected till at least after that system moves through.
All right, let's have a look at the warnings this afternoon.
There's no warnings at the moment this afternoon. It is likely tomorrow that we'll just end up with a fire weather warning out in the Eucla. It's going to be pretty hot out there with reasonably fresh northwesterly winds.
All right, but the all clear this afternoon. Thank you for that, Adam. 22 to 1 here on the Country Hour. And talking to you about milk this afternoon, whether you stick with milk, traditional milk that is, or you've gone for some of those plant-based ones like the almond or the coconut milk, for example. On the text, Stephen Mora says, A2 milk only. Only way to go for dodgy guts, apparently. Thank you for that, Steve. And this, only alternative milk for us. I never used to have a problem with dairy, but milk is not what it used to be. It causes so much stomach issues for our family, so we stopped using it. We do use butter, though. Don't understand how anyone eats plastic margarine. 0448 922 604 is the text to be part of that conversation this afternoon. An Australian nutritionist believes that dairy milk does need a rebrand, though. And the reason is she's noticed that more people are switching to these alternative milks, assuming that they are a healthier option. Figures from Dairy Australia show plant-based milks still only represent a small share of the overall milk market, but they are growing. In the last decade, they've gone from having a 5 to 7% share in the milk market. Now, that's partly because some people are seeking alternatives they hope are better for the environment. Others believe they're healthier. But are they? Dr. Annalene Padiachi is known as the simple scientist with a PhD in nutritional food science. She doesn't think so.
If a plant-based milk is properly supplemented, so that means it has added calcium, it has different vitamins and minerals added to it so that it is comparable with dairy milk, then from that perspective, they are fairly similar. If it does not have that, then we're talking about chalk and cheese, especially from a nutritional perspective. It's two different things. But the other thing that we have to realize is that milk is not just about calcium or protein or fats that we can add to another product. There are a lot of naturally bioactive components to milk. So, for example, protein in milk, it's not just protein, it's split between casein and it's split between whey. And those types of proteins have a different rate of digestibility in the body, which is you can't mimic that.
Would alternative milk ever be better for you?
It would definitely be better for you if you're lactose intolerant or something like that. If you're a flexitarian, I wouldn't say it's better for you. It's about your overall nutritional diet, overall health.
You mentioned the supplements. How many of the alternative milk varieties would actually be supplemented to the same degree to make them on an even playing field with milk?
I wouldn't be able to answer that question right now because there's just so many different varieties out there. I do know for sure that there is a particular product out there that's one of Australia's leading almond milk sellers that's not supplemented at all.
I guess one thing that you do hear, while you always haven't heard that dairy has calcium, you also hear that it has fat. Is that something about dairy that is worse than alternative milks?
No. Dairy fat, let's just put it straight out there. We're talking about milk here. Full cream milk has only got about 3.7%, 4% max fat. So we're talking about a product that is 96% fat-free. If you think about that, 96% fat-free, other products make a huge marketing campaign on that, and naturally that's all it's got in it. So it's not a bad thing. It's when you're having products that are highly concentrated in fat, like butter or oil or cream or something like that, and you're just having copious quantities of that in your diet. Yeah, we've got a bit of an issue there. Plus, you also need fat to actually enhance your absorption of different nutrients as well.
Why do you think it is that people class dairy as the less healthy option?
Probably because, well, there's a few different things. I mean, you know, in the 80s, 70s and 80s, fat was demonized. So culturally from that perspective, fat's never really been able to fully rebound from that. So then we've got the plant foods, you know, we're highly encouraged to have more plant foods in our diet, and we should. We should definitely have a more plant-based diet. A plant-based diet does not mean a plant-exclusive diet. And so when you hear those sort of messaging, plant-based, it automatically infers that if I have a plant milk, it's going to be a healthier version. It doesn't actually mean that in reality. It's about your overall dietary quality.
Do you think that dairy needs, or at least milk, needs a bit of a rebrand then, since the alternative milk share in the market is increasing?
I definitely think so, yeah. I think it needs to reinvent itself because it, no offence to the dairy sector, but it is a bit old school. It's traditional, it's children's food. It's what you have in breakfast cereal and a dash in your cup of coffee or your cup of tea, when it is not that at all. When you look at your plant milks out there, just go into any supermarket aisle and you'll see it, they really are fixated on functional benefits. So they're actually promoting their products on a range of health benefits for a specific health outcome. So a person who may have had a heart attack or is on statins or has diabetes is very acutely aware that they've got to eat carefully, whereas dairy milk doesn't really do it. So dairy milk is well entrenched throughout the years as calcium, strong bones, strong teeth in children. And it's so much more than that, so much more than that.
Dr. Annalene Padiachi, who's known as the simple scientist, talking to Tyne Logan, and she was a keynote speaker at the recent Dairy Innovation Day in WA Southwest. And on the ABC Rural Facebook page, that's a point that Tim has picked up on. He says, one nutritionist who's worked alongside the dairy industry. Yeah, no vested interest there. I'm sure she can be relied upon for factual, non-commercial health advice. not. Matthew says, instead of full cream milk, maybe they could call it 96% fat-free. That was another point that the doctor raised too. Lauren says, milk's defined by an opaque white fluid rich in fat and protein secreted by female mammals. So unless that's how you're getting it, it shouldn't be called milk, regardless of whether it's better for you or not. There are a few other comments there coming in from those opposed to animal farming, but most seem to want to switch the discussion to the environment. Like Sean says, dairy is messed up. And Forrester says, oh my God, yeah, cows, so environmentally friendly. You can join the conversation on the Facebook page if you want to. There's a link to the story there too. You might have heard Dr. Annalene Padiachi saying and using the term flexitarian. Do you know what that is? It's another label for you to throw into conversation, I guess. It's a style of eating that encourages mostly plant-based foods while allowing meat and other animal products in moderation. There's one to throw up at the next dairy, your dinner party, I should say. Dairy Australia's managing director is David Nation, and he agrees that the industry needs to work on its brand, but he doesn't think alternative milks are much of a threat.
Well, I agree that a lot of people don't recognise all the nutritional benefits of milk, and it's kind of, milk has been there forever. People have been consuming milk forever. So it's not new. Milk was one of the first things you probably drank. You know, I drank, everyone drank. It's not new and funky. It's been there forever. Our challenge is to continue to talk about them and the value that milk has in everyone's diet at all ages.
Is the shift towards alternative milk a concern to Dairy Australia?
Oh, look, these things are always a concern, because if people have forsaken dairy for the wrong reasons and given up dairy when it is actually the healthiest food they could be consuming, we obviously see that as a problem. There's always room in the market for milk and all the dairy products and alternatives. For all the discussion about alternatives for the last 10 years, alternative milk sales have gone from 5 to 7% of the market. But if you heard all the noise and you just did a survey of how many questions are being asked of dairy about alternatives, you would think alternative market is much bigger than 7%.
Dairy Australia's David Nation with Tyne Logan talking about the competition from those alternative milks. A concerned dairy farmer has texted through saying low-fat milk is actually fattier because the fat molecules are smashed up and processed that much that the body absorbs all of it, whereas full cream, the body only absorbs so much. And this from Eric. You can't beat a cold iced coffee on a stinking hot day after doing yard work. Thank you for that, Eric. It's 13 to 1. This is the Country Hour. Belinda Varaschetti with you. We'll get to the market shortly, just before the news at 1. It's off to Katanning today, so we'll get the yarding and prices at the Katanning sheep market. First, though, the nation's biggest cattle company says it's lost more than 43,000 head of cattle in the flooding of its Gulf properties in Queensland earlier this year. Now, you put that alongside the drought on its cattle stations in the Northern Territory, and the Australian Agricultural Company says both of those events have cost it more than $100 million in losses to its bottom line. In announcing its financial results to investors this morning, the CEO, Hugh Killen, says extreme weather conditions have made for an incredibly tough year.
Our EBITDA loss this year was $182.7 million. Of that, there was a $204.9 million unfavourable livestock movement within those numbers. So that's a key driver behind that number. The non-Wagyu decline of that is $138.3 million, of which 30.4 was decline in the market value of livestock, and 65.5 million of that is a decline in the lower value composite herd numbers, and that's due to increased live sales resulting from the Livingston and 1824 decisions. And also, importantly, includes a $42 million livestock write-off from the Gulf flood.
And that's overall before tax. Let's talk about Gulf losses. Extreme weather conditions, unprecedented, is that fair to say?
It was absolutely unprecedented. One in a 100-year flood, huge volumes of water, it's extremely cold, and, you know, significant impacts not just across AACo, but the entire rest of the region.
How many head do you believe you've lost?
We believe we've lost somewhere around 43,000 head. The cost of that was $42.4 million.
How are people going and the rebuild of those properties going?
The people people are extremely resilient, I'd say. My pride in the team is immense in the way they handled that situation. It was horrendous as it was flowing through. And, you know, I spent some time up there and on the ground, and huge human toll, not just for our people as well, but also our neighbours and the communities we operate in up there. But, you know, they're a resilient bunch. We've gone through the cleanup now, and now we're in the rebuild phase. So it's nothing like getting some work ahead of you to reset your mindset. And there's cattle coming in there from the Barclay at the moment, so the people are in good form. But, you know, I wouldn't like to underestimate the impact on our people and the communities at the time of the event, and probably going on for some period of time as we go through the rebuild.
The likes of Wandoola, the homestead, went underwater. Is that now habitable again? Have you managed to scrub it up?
No, we're still in the process of going through how we rebuild Wandoola in terms of the homestead complex. Where's the right place to put it? We don't just want to repeat and do a carbon copy of what we had before. So we're progressing in terms of the planning around that infrastructure, and we'll make those decisions over the next couple of months or weeks.
I can only imagine two fences were a mess. Overall, how much is the rebuild going to cost your company?
Well, we're talking about $6 to $8 million in the Gulf. That's largely water and wire, as we've disclosed. So we'll make sure we do that the right way. So what we're thinking about now is what's the right way to rebuild that infrastructure given the learnings we've had from this 1-in-100-year event. And like anything, you obviously want to learn from what's happened. So yeah, we'll think about the best way to reset that, all that infrastructure up. That includes our refuge banks. And I think we're probably the only operation up in the north that actively uses refuge banks where cattle can get up out of the water. And we'll rethink about our approach to those. And that worked pretty well for us, not as well as we were hoping, but we'll redesign those and put them in as well as the wire and water.
So despite the fact that you've still got fences down, water infrastructure out, you are restocking those properties. How are you doing all of that?
So we've got our boundary fences in place, so it's secure now. So we're bringing cattle in, we're tailing cattle across the properties. It's kind of old school, to be honest with you. We've got people out with cattle and we're building infrastructure around them as they arrived.
Bronco branding?
No, we're not quite for Bronco branding. We're still using the technology we use to identify our cattle.
Let's talk about the drought, because as you say, those cattle are coming from the Barclay. How dry are your key properties over there?
Oh, look, the Barclay, not just for us, but everyone operates in the region, the Barclay is extremely dry. And so there's a large volume of cattle coming off the Barclay, all the Barclay properties. Further south, it's okay, but, you know, the core properties around Brunette Downs and Anthony Lagoon and Avon and Austral, et cetera, are very, very dry. And there's a pretty significant movement of stock across to the Gulf, but also down into the Channel Country, some other areas where we've got better rainfall at the moment.
And you have sold a significant number of cattle as well.
Yeah, you would have seen the Longreach store sale that we did a few weeks back now. That was good, and we'll continue to assess that and make those moves as necessary and make sure we can accommodate the right cattle within our supply chain.
While that has been happening, you have had a reduction in the non-Wagyu herd numbers or group, but Wagyu AACo have still expanded. How much?
I think this is one of the really important points that I've been talking about. And just to, we've been talking about the statutory numbers. The important thing to understand is that our operating profit is up this year, and it's also been driven by our Wagyu sales, but also the growth of our Wagyu herd. And so the Wagyu herd's up 3% year on year. But, you know, when I think about the numbers that we've reported today, underlying operating profit, which includes the drought impact but excludes the Gulf flood event, is up this year. But, you know, it's up to $23.7 million, which is last year reported a $13.5 million loss. The core nucleus Wagyu herd sits within that.
Hugh Killen, he's the CEO of the Australian Agricultural Company. And overall, the company owns more than 1% of Australia's land mass, with an asset value of $1.3 billion. Now, while you might think the cure for drought is rain, some producers in Queensland are finding that after years of dry, it's going to take more than that. Now experiencing what some call a green drought, they're dealing with a whole new raft of issues. Amy McCosker has this report.
For Augathella station manager John Gardner, the rain arrived just in time.
Well, we completely unloaded. I had about 100-odd left of younger cattle that, you know, just, they were starving at the end, just about. There was nothing left, just dirt, and we were feeding.
Then the rains came and the season turned, albeit late.
Finished up here with 118 mil in the first lot, and then we got another 50 mil, was just made the grass just jump out of the ground.
He says while he's counting his blessings, he feels he's gone from one type of drought to another.
Here, well, there's four dams that are only quarter full, and one dam that's still completely empty. Green grass and no water, well, you've got to work just as hard as being a dry drought because you've got to keep pumping water, you know, and that's expensive. But, yeah, that's what they call a green drought, the grass and no water. Yeah, no water for stock, no water for your house, no water for your gardens. It's the same thing. It goes hand in hand. And it makes it hard. People get really desperate because they've got heaps of feed. They've run out of water because the dams never got filled up because the rain was so steady. It was beautiful rain, just unbelievable. But there again, we never got any heavy falls. We needed those 3 or 4 inches of good heavy downpour to make the water run, but it didn't. It just all went into the ground and it just grew grass and grew grass and grew grass and. Yeah, the country looks just unbelievable.
On top of access to water for stock, the quick change in season brings with it other challenges. Recent rain has led to outbreaks of cattle illnesses caused by wet weather and access to lush green grass after months or perhaps years of dry pasture and supplements. Mr. Gardner says he's heard reports of bloat and three-day sickness.
There's that much grass and pigweed and bloody, just the herbage that has come up in the and the wildflowers, but also we have the biggest crop of goat head I've ever seen ever anywhere. We were pretty lucky because our cattle were full of hay and stuff all the time, but few other people have this, especially travelling stock that have moved into the area like quickly, and they've been hungry and they come out of the yard and they eat it. And it can roll them within a couple of hours, they're down on the ground and really hard.
What about 3 day?
Yes, there's been a bit of 3 day around, around Charm or Cullamulla. There's been a fair bit. I've had a couple here.
Longreach animal nutrition consultant Desiree Jackson says it can be a somewhat confusing time for producers who've been managing drought affected cattle and country for so long.
So there appears to be a lot of bulk now, but if you actually took out all the different feeds that cattle and sheep wouldn't willingly consume, there isn't a lot of standing dry matter available for stock to actually carry them right through. So people have to be really careful about managing stock numbers at the moment.
Desiree Jackson, animal nutrition consultant based in Longreach in Queensland. Off to the markets right now, and a much smaller yarding of sheep at Katanning today. In fact, half the size of last week's sale. Almost 16,900 sold this morning. Tracy Kilner, can you run through the details?
The yarding was again dominated by lightweight and store lambs, with the prices remaining firm to up, with very strong competition for the air freight suitable lambs. A pen of extra heavy lamb sold for a top of 197, while good quality mutton saw prices gain again this week, selling to a top of $161 a head. Light lambs under 12 kilos carcass weight sold from $30 to $96. Lambs under 16 kilos carcass weight gained $10, selling from $75 to $137. And the air freight weights under 18 kilos sold from $110 to $149 a head. Trade weight lambs made from $135 to $169, while heavy lambs sold from $164 to $197 a head. The young ewes gained on demand, selling for $77 for the small frames, up to $140 for quality ewes to average $105 a head. The light store boning ewes down to 14 kilos gained $6, making from $60 to $89 a head. Medium weight ewes in the 18 to 23 kilo category weight range made from $75 to $120 a head, including skins. Good quality heavy mutton over 24 kilos carcass weight sold from $110 to $161 a head. Weathers sold processors from $85 to $144 depending on weight, while restockers paid $60 to $127 for the lighter weight store weathers offered. Mature rams sold for $20 to $130 to processors, averaging $60 a head, while a good quality run of ram lambs sold for $82 to $194, averaging $130 a head. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you very much, Tracy. It's a minute to one.
Join us for The World Today.
Hello, I'm Eleanor Hall. On the program today, the New South Wales towns on the brink of running out of water. Australia's property market could be on the rise again. What do prospective homebuyers think?
With the sort of lower interest rate, you've got less of a mortgage to pay back. And it also means a lot of the properties that people are holding, they're not having to pay back as much to the banks. So that's all good.
And are they the original hipsters? Belgian monks join the craft beer trend, resuming their brewing habits after a 220-year hiatus.
More than the headlines, the world today.
And you can see that story about the monk's beer online. It has 10.8% alcohol, so packs a punch. Time for the news, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.